If you look at a massive suspension bridge, like the first thing you notice is how incredibly rigid it
Oh,
appears.
yeah. All that steel and concrete.
Right. You see these towering pillars and the thick cables, and you instinctively think, well, that thing is never going to move. But the secret to a suspension bridge surviving a hurricane isn't its rigidity, it's actually the exact opposite.
It's the ability to sway.
Exactly.
Because if the bridge can't flex, I mean, the tension just builds and builds until the concrete cracks and the steel snaps.
Yeah, it just breaks.
Right? So it's that elasticity, that structural capacity to yield to immense external pressure that keeps the whole thing standing when the environment around it just turns completely hostile.
And that structural capacity for flexibility under extreme pressure is exactly what we are exploring today. But instead of civil engineering, we are looking at the architecture of the human mind.
Which is fascinating.
It really is. Specifically, we're looking at how we learn and how we build systems for learning when the world around us feels like it's shaking. So, welcome to another deep dive.
Glad to be here. We have a really diverse stack of sources to go through today.
We do. We're looking at these massive provincial policy frameworks from Canada, a deeply insightful 2015 research paper, some modern studies on the neurobiology of stress, and the expansive portfolio of an award-winning e-learning experience architect named Gary Bartanis.
Right, and our mission today is to figure out how analyzing macro-level government e-learning strategies actually gave him the blueprint to pioneer a highly empathetic, trauma-informed digital learning architecture.
And given the political and economic tumult you are likely navigating out there in 2026, this concept of learning and adapting under pressure, well, it couldn't be more relevant to your daily life. So let's unpack this.
Yeah, to really understand the modern human-centric course design that we are seeing today in 2026, we actually have to look backward first. We have to examine the bureaucratic successes and failures of the past.
Which brings us to environmental stressors on a massive scale.
Exactly, because what Bartanis realized early in his career is that by studying the macro-level structures of massive educational institutions, we can find the exact same blueprint for how a single human brain reacts to stress.
So the source materials kick off with a research paper he co-authored during his Master of Educational Technology at UBC back in 2015.
Right.
It compares how two Canadian giants, Ontario and Alberta, handled the massive shift toward e-learning. It's literally titled A Tale of Two Provinces.
It's a brilliant comparative study, honestly, because you have two entirely different approaches resulting in different types of chaos. Let's look at Ontario first.
Okay, the giant.
Yeah, the research frames Ontario's approach as a classic catch-up model. At the time, Ontario had experienced a pretty long period of political stability. But despite that calm environment, the province seriously lacked top-down, systematic leadership in the digital learning space.
They were just toasting.
Pretty much, they were
Yeah.
totally coasting.
But the sources mention they introduced a differentiation policy framework around 2013 to try and fix that, right? What did that actually look like on the ground?
Well, the underlying idea was actually quite sound. They used what were called strategic mandate agreements, or SMAs. Think of an SMA as a formal agreement forcing their 45 publicly funded institutions to reduce duplication.
So basically, a mandate saying, hey, figure out what your specific university is uniquely good at and stop copying the university down the street. Like,
Exactly. But the execution of this framework was deeply flawed. The government took a very hands-off approach initially, and they drastically delayed releasing the actual funding details tied to these mandates.
wait, so you have 45 massive institutions told to overhaul their strategies, but they have zero idea what their budget is going to be.
Right, and they were given only 5 months to submit these comprehensive plans.
Oh, wow.
You can imagine the scramble. I mean, the result was an incredibly fragmented landscape. 39 of those institutions featured prominent, ambitious plans to increase online learning.
But without cohesive stewardship or, clear funding from the top, you just get perpetual delays.
Exactly. Initiatives like Ontario Online, which the government had promised back in 2010, they still hadn't fully materialized by mid-2015.
So the universities themselves were pushing forward as best they could, but the provincial government was essentially just playing catch up to its own schools.
Yeah, it was an environment of high ambition, but massive structural clutter.
Okay, so that's Ontario, a lack of stewardship leading to a fragmented scramble. But then you have Alberta, which the sources contrast as the structured trailblazer.
Alberta was playing an entirely different game. As early as 2002, they established the Campus Alberta framework. This wasn't a reactionary last-minute scramble at all.
It was planned out.
Highly structured, It was a collaborative system built on very clear principles. They wanted to make learning accessible, innovative, and deeply responsive to lifelong learners. And for a decade, it worked beautifully.
The numbers back that up, right?
Oh, definitely. It yielded 10 straight years of massive growth for the Campus Alberta Consortium. We are talking over 22,000 course registrations by 2014 alone.
But then the environment turns hostile. The global oil crash of 2013 hits.
Right, and the economic shocks were brutal. Sinking global oil prices led the provincial government to suddenly slash $147 million from post-secondary operating grants.
That is a massive cut.
Huge. And the sources dig into the specific political whiplash here, too. They detail the progressive conservative government's budget cuts, which the documents actually describe as reckless, and how a new NDP government later tried to reverse them.
Which, just to pause here for you listening, we really need to make clear that we aren't taking any political sides today.
Definitely not.
Regardless of who was sitting in the premier's chair, whether it was the longstanding Liberals in Ontario or the political tug of war in Alberta, what we are analyzing today is purely the structural impact. The politics are just the weather. We're just looking at how the bridge held up to the storm.
That's a great way to put it. And the bridge in Alberta did not hold up well. What followed those sudden budget cuts was just wild. The advanced education minister started firing off these chaotic, non-negotiable letters of expectation to the universities.
The infamous mandate letters.
Yeah, they were incredibly aggressive. The ministers essentially demanded that institutions centralize administration and reduce duplication immediately, with zero room for debate.
He even publicly challenged the necessity of having multiple engineering or education schools across the province.
Right, and the universities obviously viewed this as a direct hostile attack on their academic autonomy. The entire system was thrown into absolute paralysis.
Like Athabasca University, right? They were a major player in distance education, and they had to announce dozens of layoffs almost immediately just to cope with the sudden financial and bureaucratic strangulation.
Exactly. It seized up the whole system.
Okay, I want to make sure I'm visualizing this dynamic correctly.
Yeah.
So Ontario was basically like a massive, uncoordinated potluck dinner where everyone brought whatever dish they wanted.
Right.
And because nobody was in charge, they ended up with 5 fruitcakes, a bag of chips, and no main course.
It's spot on.
Meanwhile, Alberta was a perfectly structured, highly synchronized marching band. But halfway through the parade, someone stole their instruments, slashed their funding, and demanded they still play the symphony perfectly on a moment's notice.
That is a brilliant way to picture it.
Yeah.
And imagine being a trumpet player in that marching band. You are suddenly being punished for not playing music on an instrument you no longer possess while someone screams non-negotiable demands at you.
It sounds like a nightmare.
The immense paralyzing stress of that moment is exactly what caught Gary Bartanis' attention. This historical comparison reveals how both a complete lack of stewardship and extreme authoritarian control create a paralyzing rigidity within an institution.
When systems are subjected to those kinds of extremes, they lose their elasticity. They just seize up. You know, looking at how Alberta's massive institutions completely seized up when hit with those top-down mandate letters, it feels oddly familiar. It's almost exactly what happens to a person when they panic.
And that biological parallel is the exact leap Bartanis made. While studying this institutional chaos in 2015, he recognized that students respond to punitive top-down control the exact same way that institutions do.
It just shut down entirely.
They completely shut down.
So forcing a rigid, non-negotiable mandate on a university's administration is structurally identical to forcing a rigid, authoritarian teaching style on a stressed student.
Yes. You can actually see this evolution clearly in his academic e-portfolio from that time. He places a heavy, intentional focus on moving educational design away from objectivism and toward constructivism.
Okay, let's define those for a second because they sound a bit dense. If I'm a student sitting in a classroom, what is the actual difference between experiencing objectivism versus constructivism?
Well, think of objectivism as the classic rigid lecture hall. The underlying belief is that knowledge is a hard, concrete object, and the teacher's job is to simply pour that object into your head, regardless of your internal state, your background, or your stress levels.
Right. You sit down, you stay quiet, and you absorb the mandate.
Exactly. Constructivism, on the other hand, is the collaborative workshop. It's the belief that learners actually have to build knowledge together, making meaning out of their own experiences and connecting new information to what they already know.
So it's much more active.
Yes. And Bartanis realized that when external control becomes absolute and punitive, like the objectivist lecture hall or the Alberta mandate letters, the internal agency of the learner just collapses.
Which raises a massive challenge for anyone trying to design a learning experience today. If top-down, rigid control crushes a person's ability to process information, how do we build courses for people who are already overwhelmed by the external tumult of 2026?
To solve that, Martinez had to move beyond policy and dive deep into the actual neurobiology of the human brain. Which brings us to trauma-informed instructional design, or TEL-ID.
And here's where the science gets fascinating. Because the sources are very clear that trauma isn't just a bad memory or a fleeting emotional state. It is a biological reality that literally reshapes how a developing brain distributes energy.
It does. When a student experiences toxic stress, and keep in mind, longitudinal studies indicate that roughly 60% of adults have experienced at least one adverse childhood experience, the brain fundamentally alters its operations.
Right.
When a person perceives a threat, the brain immediately diverts energy away from the prefrontal cortex.
And I know the prefrontal cortex does the heavy lifting for logic and executive function, but what actually happens to a learner when that energy is diverted?
Well, the energy leaves the centers responsible for higher order thinking, planning, and complex problem solving, and it is sent straight to the amygdala and the brainstem.
The survival centers.
Exactly. Those are the areas that manage pure survival instincts. The fight, flight, or freeze response.
Mm.
So the biological reality of a stressed brain is that it literally cannot learn.
Wow.
The neurological structures required to process and retain complex, nuanced information are temporarily powered down in favor of keeping you alive.
I was trying to picture this earlier, and it feels exactly like a fire alarm going off inside a school building. You cannot possibly expect a student to sit calmly at their desk and learn advanced calculus if their internal alarm bell is screaming that the building is on fire.
Right.
You have to turn off the alarm before any learning can happen.
That is the perfect analogy. And the downstream impacts of that internal fire alarm are severe. The research shows that chronic toxic stress leads to an overactive amygdala and chronically elevated cortisol levels.
And how does that show up in a classroom?
In a learning environment, this manifests as hypervigilance, emotional exhaustion, or sudden outbursts. It can reduce activity in the hippocampus, meaning students will actively struggle with memory retrieval and reading fluency. It even impairs basic language processing.
So if you're an instructional designer, you can't just build a visually prettier calculus presentation. You have to actively design an environment that lowers the learner's cortisol.
Exactly.
And this is where Bartanis's research takes a deeply unexpected turn. He finds a profound alignment between this cutting-edge neurobiology and an educational philosophy from a 19th century writer named Ellen G. White.
It is a remarkable historical parallel.
Yeah.
The 1800s, the prevailing pedagogy was heavily, unapologetically authoritarian.
Right.
The common accepted goal of education was literally to break the will of a child to force total behavioral compliance. It was the ultimate non-negotiable top-down mandate.
But White fiercely rejected that entire approach.
She did. She argued that punitive, authoritarian methods crushed the spirit and merely create a more determined rebellion of the heart. She believed that it was fundamentally wrong for one human mind to be under the complete dominating control of another.
Yeah, she explicitly warned that when a teacher relies on absolute control, the student becomes a mere automaton or a well-drilled soldier.
Right, they might follow orders while the teacher is watching, but they completely lack the internal strength and agency to govern themselves once that authority figure leaves the room.
Which maps perfectly to what we were just saying about institutions and students losing their internal agency when they are stripped of flexibility. So if she rejected breaking the will, what was her alternative for getting a student to learn?
She advocated for a highly relational redemptive model of education, which she called the Jesus Method. It is a specific sequential five-stage framework based entirely on empathy.
Okay.
The sequence goes mingling, sympathizing, ministering, winning confidence, and finally, bidding them to follow me.
Let me make sure I have that progression. Mingling, sympathizing, ministering, winning confidence, and then follow me.
That's the sequence. And what is truly profound is how this 19th century philosophy perfectly maps onto the modern SAM-HSA guidelines for trauma-informed care today.
SAM-HSA being the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration.
Right. They identify key evidence-based principles like safety, trustworthiness, empowerment, and choice.
They are structurally identical.
They really are. In both frameworks, you never start by demanding academic or behavioral compliance. You start with mingling. In a modern digital course, that might look like establishing a welcoming presence, clear navigation, and a sense of safety.
Okay, that makes sense.
Then comes sympathizing, which is building genuine empathy. Then you minister to their immediate needs, which, going back to your analogy, is a process of actively turning off that internal fire alarm.
Right, lowering the cortisol.
Exactly. When you do that, you win confidence, establishing SAMHS's principle of trustworthiness. Only then, once the prefrontal cortex is powered back up and the student feels fundamentally safe, do you bid them to follow me into the rigorous, challenging work of actual learning.
That is incredible. A philosophy from the 1800s perfectly predicting the neurobiological requirements of the 21st century human brain.
It really is wild.
But this brings us to the ultimate practical question for our listeners. We are living in 2026. The world is heavily digitized, deeply automated, and moving at light speed. How on earth does Bartanis actually implement a 19th century redemptive learning architecture into modern software and glowing digital screens?
Well, this is where his current professional practice, Agape Learning Design, bridges the gap between historical theory and modern execution. He takes these trauma-informed principles and codes them directly into digital spaces.
Also,
he uses modern software infrastructure tools like Moodle and Articulate 360, which are essentially the lumber and drywall of digital learning, and combines them with carefully vetted artificial intelligence to build what his portfolio calls safe online spaces for academic and spiritual growth.
Wait, hold on. I have to push back on that for a second. You are talking about trauma-informed, deeply empathetic, emotional healing spaces, but you just mentioned artificial intelligence.
I did.
Usually when we think of AI in 2026, we think of cold algorithms, rigid data processing, and a complete lack of humanity. Isn't using AI to build an empathetic space a massive contradiction?
It absolutely sounds like a contradiction on the surface.
Yeah.
But the genius is in how he deploys the technology. Bartanis uses AI and what he calls macro automation to handle all the rigid, repetitive bureaucratic tasks of course building. He uses the algorithms to automate the structural clutter.
Oh, I see. By offloading the robotic administrative work to the actual robots, he frees up the human elements.
Exactly. The AI handles the heavy structural lifting grading frameworks, data sorting, basic formatting, which allows the human instructional designer to focus entirely on the student's emotional and cognitive needs.
That is so smart.
He automates the rigid structure so he can personalize the empathy.
That makes so much sense. So what does the actual user interface look like once he's applied this trauma-informed lens to it? How does a student experience this?
Well, it looks fundamentally different from a traditional objectivist online course.
Yeah.
For one, he heavily relies on microlearning.
Okay.
Instead of overwhelming an already stressed brain with a dense 2-hour video lecture, he breaks the content down into highly digestible micro videos and just-in-time learning modules. This directly manages the student's cognitive load, preventing that biological brain fatigue we talked about.
He also uses a lot of digital storytelling, right? I noticed that highlighted in his skills breakdown.
Yes. He uses interactive media and branching scenarios to build that mingling and sympathizing connection digitally. But he goes even further by applying trauma-informed design to the actual visual environment.
Like the actual layout of the screen.
Yeah. For example, he uses highly predictable wayfinding and clear signposting. A trauma-informed space means a student never feels lost, confused, or tricked by the interface. They always know exactly where they are and how to get back. He also incorporates biophilia into the digital design.
Biophilia meaning a connection to nature. How does that work on a screen?
It means using natural color palettes, organic shapes, and imagery of the outdoors, rather than harsh, clinical, or overly gamified interfaces. Extensive research proves that simply viewing natural elements can actually lower human cortisol levels.
Wow, so the screen itself helps.
Right. He is designing the digital interface to literally soothe the user's central nervous system while they learn.
And the real-world results of this humanity-centered approach are staggering. I mean, his designs won a National Award for Learning Design Excellence from the Canadian Credit Union Association.
Yes, they did.
He built a compliance course called Federal 101 for First West Credit Union, and it achieved a 98.6% completion rate among over 1,200 employees.
A 98.6% completion rate in mandatory corporate training is almost unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
Usually people click through those as fast as possible just to make them go away.
Exactly.
But his more recent work as a clinician educator at Island Health, where he developed an AI literacy quiz called Spot the Bot, proves the concept once again. By building digital courses that adapt to the physiological and psychological needs of the learner, rather than forcing the learner to blindly adapt to a rigid top-down mandate, deep, meaningful learning actually happens.
It's a complete paradigm shift.
He essentially took the lessons of Alberta's institutional paralysis and reversed them to engineer individual empowerment.
Which brings us right back to you listening to this deep dive today. Why does this matter to your life? In 2026, we are constantly surrounded by political shifts, economic whiplash, and technological disruption. It can often feel like institutional chaos is just the water we swim in.
It really can.
But whether you are prepping for a high-stakes boardroom meeting, managing a remote team spread across time zones, or just trying to learn a complex new skill yourself, understanding how to navigate and design empathetic, trauma-informed spaces is a modern superpower.
Absolutely.
It is about recognizing that flexibility, choice, and empathy aren't just nice-to-haves or soft skills for HR brochures. They are absolute structural requirements for a resilient system.
And that leaves us with the final fascinating paradox to consider as you go about your day. If a relational educational philosophy from the 1800s could perfectly predict the neurobiological requirements of the 21st century human brain, what deeply ingrained traditional rigidities in your own workplace, your own leadership style, or your own daily routine are secretly acting as trauma triggers right now?
That is a great question.
Right. And more importantly, how can you redesign your own daily architectures to heal rather than harm?
If the suspension bridge can't sway, it snaps. Make sure your architectures have the capacity to sway. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.